Open the Rules Committee and note that there are five of us, so we do have a quorum. So with that, we will begin. And as is general in this meeting, the order means nothing, so stay tuned for which ones. But I will make a couple announcements. House Bill 3153A, we're waiting for some amendments and some other things that are happening on that bill. So it will be moved to, and we'll repost it Friday a week from now, so it's about 8 or 9 days ahead. House Bill 3401 is moved till this coming Friday, so it's moved off the schedule. And House Bill 3004A is moved also to Friday, coming up Friday. So that being said, and that one of those was on the back of the agenda, in case you couldn't find it, because we had a long list. And as you know, at this time, people are getting a little harried with regard to getting amendments out, and so we schedule them trying to get the amendments. Some of them can't make it, and some do. So we're going to start, because Representative Barker is here, with 2682A, and we're going to open, right now we'll open a public hearing. So with that, Representative Barker and his two people can come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the committee, Jeff Barker, House District 28. I appreciate you accommodating the schedule. I do need to be back at another committee meeting. This bill has to do with what is normally called bail bonds. And what we're asking to do is, and we just got the amendment literally hot off the press mere moments ago to the correct bill. We had another one that didn't quite go with the bill. And it's to set up a study group for the interim and to be able to process this. Part of the problem has been large amounts of people who do not show up when they're required to be in court, which costs the counties and the cities a lot of money. For example, in Portland, when I would show up to court and the defendant would not show up, I got 6 hours paid just for the 5 minutes I was there. And that was very expensive. The city also was expensive to me personally when I would lose a day, wouldn't be able to do things, wasn't able to take the kids to the ball game or whatever. So this will help everybody if we could have defendants show up on time, officers show up on time, and the courts can proceed much smoother.
And we just got the amendments, so you'll have them. We will not be moving the bill today, but we're getting the amendments just so we're getting the testimony. So with that, we'll have our next two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the American Bail Bonds Coalition. We are very much in support of this. We actually have been trying to get everybody together to study the feasibility of bringing bail bonds back into the system. We believe that it will save the state a lot of money through the traditional bail system. We're not talking about bringing Dog, the bail bondsman, back into the state, but it's a system that is around the country in 46 of the 50 states. It works. It works without government involvement. The bill right now is a study of the system. It allows the Interim Judiciary Committee to look at the situation and bring back, hopefully to the February session if you have one, or to the next general session of the legislature, a system that will save you money, potentially solve some of the prison overcrowding problems with the secured release, and just overall be a good thing for the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I represent Aladdin Bail Bond, which is the largest retailer of bail bond services in the United States. We, too, are in support of the Dash A6s. The difference between the Dash A6s and the A.N. Gross bill, which passed unanimously out of House Judiciary Committee to this committee, is basically some shalls to May wording changes to hopefully eliminate the fiscal. That's our understanding from staff, that that will have the effect of eliminating the fiscal impact.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Saying that, you being here, and we're going to close our hearing on House Bill 2682. No, that's all of them. And now, again, to expedite some people who are here, make sure I get the right list that I have. Which one's Paul Evans here on? Yeah, I just have my list. Oh, here it is. I got it. Yep. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3480. Because, again, we have some people who are leaving quickly. And we'll have a short explanation of the bill. Public hearing.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3480 authorizes the Oregon Military Department to make payments to members of the National Guard, Oregon National Guard, exposed to hexavalent chromium while serving at a specified water treatment plant in Basra, Iraq in 2003, and who developed cancer as a result of the exposure. It directs the department to adopt rules for eligibility and amounts of payments, appropriates monies from the general fund for purposes of making payments, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2009. The background is essentially this. In 2003, members of the Oregon, South Carolina, Indiana National Guard were stationed at the Qawmat Ali water treatment plant in southern Iraq. During their tour of duty, they were exposed to hexavalent chromium, a known human carcinogen. Hexavalent chromium increases the risk of lung cancer when inhaled on a regular basis for even short periods of time. Adverse effects can arise years later. The National Guard was present to protect civilian workers of KBR, a Houston-based Pentagon contractor, which had been hired to repair the plant as part of the Restore Iraq Oil project. The plant, which provides water to the southern oil fields of Iraq, had been contaminated with sodium dichromate before it was abandoned prior to the invasion of Iraq by the United States. Sodium dichromate, a substance used to clear corrosion on pipes, contains hexavalent chromium. In March 2008, civilians working for KBR sued KBR for damages. Guardsmen in Indiana subsequently filed suit against KBR in December 2008. In June 2008, a congressional hearing was held to investigate an alleged cover-up of the 2003 plant contamination and subsequent exposure of National Guard troops providing security there. According to an article in the Oregonian in March of 2009, the Oregon Guard sent 286 letters to soldiers of the 1st Battalion, 162nd Infantry Division about possible exposure. Fewer than 20 had responded to the Department of Veterans Affairs or the Guard at that time, at the time of the article. The article asserts that some 93 Oregon soldiers may still not know that they have been exposed to hexavalent chromium. The Oregon Guard sent registered letters notifying them in early March 2009 about the exposure.
Thank you. And with that, whichever of the representatives want to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent Inner North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon House of Representatives, District 43. In early 2003, an industrial water plant near Basra in southern Iraq was destroyed and looted as Iraqi military pulled back and U.S. and British troops advanced as part of Operation Iraqi Freedom. Between June and November 2003, U.S. contractors led by Kellogg Brown and Root were brought into the plant to repair it on an operation called Restore Iraqi Oil. Clearly labeled hexavalent chromium bags were stockpiled, but much was spilled at the site. They stained the concrete floors and colored the surrounding sands in the desert in a very bright yellow. National Guard troops from Indiana and Oregon were stationed at the plant to guard and protect the KBR workers and the plant. Now, there were no shortages of warning signs of extreme toxicity. An example is when a civil medic at Blackie grew concerned that there were health problems, and he began to query the KBR, Halliburton, Iraqi Oil Company, U.S. National Guard, and British soldiers, and found that these personnel were all suffering from identical symptoms: continuous bloody noses, spitting up blood, coughing, irritation of the eyes, throats and lung, and shortness of breath. Now, there is virtually no doubt that KBR's managers knew the site was contaminated, but that information evidently was never given to our troops, and our troops were never given protective gear.
Scott Ashby
and Larry Roberta will tell more about how this crime has drastically affected their lives, and Representative Cameron represents Mr. Roberta and expressed his apologies that he could not be here, but he wanted to express his support for Larry and his family in the bill. Now, there has been an outpouring of support for this bill. The family members of veterans have written in, and I'd like to share with you some of the sentiments that I've heard from other vets who have written in about the bill. Representative Shields, I absolutely applaud your stance in support of House Bill 3480. Such a measure only begins to scratch the surface of this issue. The armed forces, it is appalling to think that the sacrifices made by these men and women are barely acknowledged, and the lifelong struggles they face as a consequence of service to their country are looked upon with anything but honor. I have some experience with how it must feel to have to fight for recognition, fight for benefits, and simply fight for survival, battles which seem to make the tour of duty almost inconsequential in comparison. Bring their fight to the forefront. All veterans will benefit from championing this cause. And I think it's appropriate for us to take on this issue during the week of Armed Services Day. And as chair of the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means, I'm dedicated to making sure our nationally recognized troop reintegration program is funded adequately. That's crucial to make sure our troops have an advocate and helping hand in that fight. This bill marks this failure of Kellogg, Brown, and Root, this failure of the United States, and this failure of Oregon to protect our troops, and it marks it for history. One Guard soldier, Sergeant Nicholas Thomas, has already died of leukemia. At least two others of our troops have contracted cancer. In closing, I thank Julie Sullivan of the Oregonian for tenaciously investigating this issue. This bill is about marking this tragedy for history. It's all about standing up for our soldiers and their families. And I say to you, passing this bill is a very modest recognition of their pain and sacrifice. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd now like to pass it over to Representative Van Orman, who will make some comments in support, and then we will go to Mr. Ashby.
Thank you.
Why don't pull the mic? Yeah, pull the mic over. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Representative Suzanne Van Orman, representing House District 52, Hood River, Multnomah, Clackamas County. And I'm here today to lend support out of respect for the young people that have stepped forward and have gone to service, and that they've come home with a disability that no one ever anticipated. I think that we are experiencing a questionable contractor with questionable activities and questionable oversight. And these young people are suffering because of that. And I think the proposal before us is modest. And I think that because these young people volunteered, I think they deserve our respect.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you. Chair, committees, meeting. Thank you for taking the time to listen to my testimony. My name is Scott Ashby. According to the statement that I'm going to give you, is my account of Iraq of 2003 and 2004. It was June in the summer of 2003, and I was a part of the 41st Infantry Brigade, Company C, when I came upon the water treatment plants in Basra, Iraq. At this time, our mission was Operation Restore Iraqi Oil, RIO. It was well on its way. As we were given our fire missions from day to day, we did not know our missions until they were given out in the morning briefings. In this month of June, we escorted the KBR employees to their day-to-day missions. We oversaw and seen their protection in and out of Iraq from the oil fields and the water treatment plants in Qarman Ali. On these missions, we would secure the vehicles and the people on their job sites as they went along doing their jobs day-to-day. During this time, I observed an abundance of this powder substance on the ground, covering all the pipes in the area and the water treatment plants. Myself and others at this time were not concerned about the substance, but because of our mission, we were to focus on the attacks of the hostile forces in the area. At the end of March of 2004, near the end of our deployment, during a debriefing, we were told that we were exposed to sodium dichromate and at the water treatment plants in Basra, Iraq. At this meeting, we were told this was not to be exposed. It's not long enough to do any damage to us. When I left the Oregon National Guard in the summer of 2004, I did not receive any more information about this toxic chemicals. In the winter of 2009, I was shocked to read in the Oregonian that not only had some of my fellow soldiers died from a rare form of cancer, but the Indiana National Guard men that were also in the area of the same place were dying from a rare form of cancer. After reading this disturbing report, I learned that the sodium dichromate that was called Julie Sullivan at the Oregonian had shared with her about myself and other people on my fire team. We were a part of the operation at Restore Iraqi Oil, and we were at the water treatment plants at that time. At the concern of my members for my fire team, I started making calls to let them know how they were reacting to this news. Needless to say, they were shocked and from the news, and they wondered why no one from the Oregon Army National Guard had not contacted us with this information. 2 weeks later, we received letters from the Army National Guard stating that we were exposed to hexachromate, a component of sodium dichromate, and it was known as a potential toxin with numerous health effects. At this time, it concerned, I contacted my physician at the Veterans Medical Hospital and was scheduled for a preliminary test. The outcome is I have been diagnosed with an unknown upper respiratory problem. I stand here today to ask for help for myself and my fellow soldiers who fought with me in the United States Army and Iraqi freedom. We fought with duty and honor and served our country. We did this so we could protect the preservation and right of liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Please stand with me to pass this bill to help protect our rights of these men and women who serve this great country of ours. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Garrard.
Mr. Asher, thank you for serving your country.
You're welcome.
Who's taking care of the medical bills?
At this time, the VA is concerned about our problems. It is so new that they have no idea what they're dealing with. The first person, obviously, I was pretty much on the scene, hadn't even received the letters from the Oregon Army National Guard yet. He did not even know what to test for. He was not notified. They are going into this extremely blind.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions for these witnesses?
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yes, please.
If we could please bring up Larry Ruperta, and you can stay up here. But Representative Van Orman might step aside.
Well, Representative, thank you for listening to me today.
And don't forget to identify yourself.
My name is Lawrence Roberta.
Thanks.
Everything Scott has already said, I can tell you how it's affected me. I suffer from reactive airway disorder. I can't even walk a block and a half to my mailbox without having to puff on my inhalers. I have two. One's a steroid to help open my lungs up. I had to have a Nissen wrap, which is they take the top part of your stomach and wrap it around your esophagus because the valve into my stomach was no longer there. While I was in Iraq at the water treatment plant, the sodium dichromate was everywhere. It was stacked in bags. It appeared that somebody had taken the bags to the doors because it was stored in buildings and physically stacked it there and destroyed the bag, so you had to walk through it to be exposed to it, to get in. And like Scott said, we had to protect the people that were going into these buildings, so we had to climb through it just like they did, up and over and through, and I had some of the chemical blow onto my face, onto my chicken patty, you know, while I was eating. I tried washing it off, and all I can say is it burnt like hell going down. I have pains in my lungs, go all the way through to my back. I have to take painkillers for those every single day, along with the inhalers. I have post-traumatic stress disorder, you wouldn't believe. I could fill up probably the whole rest of your day. And I'm sure you don't want to listen to it. I know I don't want to talk about it.
So, thank you. Other questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, and thank you both for your service, and thank you for coming down here today. What does this look like? It was just orange powder that was everywhere? You said that the bags were open and you were just walking through it. What does it look like?
It's a crystalline powder. There was actually three different types of things that I remember. There was sodium dichromate. There was garnet. Garnet is a kind of a crushed rock. And there was activated charcoal. It was just all over the place. There was one guy, I forgot what his name was, an Iraqi guy that was working in one of the rooms there that he had sores all over him. He looked like a methamphetamine addict with all the sores from the chromium that he was showing us. And I'm like, okay. But the Army was saying, oh, this is nothing. But then after I got home, I looked at the MSDS, the Material Safety Data Sheet, on the Internet, and I'm like, how can this be what this is, what the Army is saying this is? This absolutely makes no sense whatsoever. I absolutely feel like they just flat out lied to us. And whenever you tried to go get help, you know, the medics, the Army medics would say, oh, you're just trying to get out of your job. Go back to your job.
So, Paul, you were having symptoms while you were in Basra.
Yes.
You were feeling the effects of this.
As a matter of fact, my father-in-law had a brain surgery in July of 2003, so I came home on emergency leave, and I was so sick I couldn't figure out why. The medics wouldn't help me, so I went to my regular doctor, and my regular doctor took some blood, and he says, well, your liver enzymes are like through the roof, and he goes, we need to figure out why, and I said, well, unfortunately, I won't be here long enough for you to do any follow-up tests, and my doctor was pretty concerned, but of course, I had to go back. And when I went back and told my first sergeant that when I got back in September, we had a briefing in November at Port Schwaba. And my first sergeant physically grabbed me and took me up to the lieutenant colonel who gave the briefing and said, you need to talk to this man. And they took me to Camp Doha in Kuwait, gave me a bunch of tests, and he filled out this paperwork. And on that paperwork, it says specifically that I will have adverse health defects or effects due to my exposure to sodium dichromate. Specifically says that.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. is there anything happening? Are there any forms of compensation coming from the federal government on this?
Well, after I've been, oh my gosh, if you add up all of my other problems that I have, I think I had to be almost like 300% disabled to be considered 100% disabled. So with a family, I get $20-some-odd hundred a month, which is nowhere near what I made when I worked at Xerox and before when I was a police officer.
So, I guess what I wanted is it's kind of a strange question, and I do thank you for your service to our country and to our state. The two other sacks of stuff you indicated, the garnet and the activated charcoal, are definitely things that they use in almost all treatment plants. Is this other ingredient used in the treatment plant? I mean, why was it there? Do we know?
To my knowledge, what I found out afterwards, I finally watched the movie Aaron Brockovich just a few months ago, and I went, is that the same stuff? So I got on the internet and I looked, and what they the water is for is you have to pump the water into the ground to keep the ground pressure equal in order to extract the oil. Now, obviously, you can't just pump straight water through steel pipes, otherwise they corrode. It's an anti-corrosion agent.
Oh, okay.
That makes some sense to me. Discovered.
So it was there for the oil wells more than it was there for the water treatment part of the plant. Got you. Okay, that makes some sense. I appreciate that. Appreciate that information for me. Other questions?
Thank you.
Yes, thank you all. Is there other? Yes, Representative Shields.
Mr. Chair, when I introduced this bill, it was to call attention to this issue for all Oregonians so that we could begin to make some atonement for the failure that we have done in how we treat our warriors. I want you to know that there is the possibility of amending this bill to increase the dollar amount, and there is the possibility of amending this bill so that the third party who is primarily responsible or largely responsible, Kellogg Brown and Root, might reimburse the state at the conclusion of legal action.
And I guess my question is, do you have any amendments at this time? Is it something we should work here, or is it something that this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, obviously, so.
Because it is getting late in the session, sending it on to Ways and Means might be a proper way to go, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Any further testimony?
Mr. Evans may have had to leave, left, but Paul Evans from the Governor's Office said they absolutely support the bill.
Okay. So we will close our public hearing on House Bill 3480. People here ready to move this bill to the Ways and Means? We don't have the physical. It's going to Ways and Means, so we can suspend the rules for that if we would like to. Okay. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3480. I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, do you need the rules suspended?
Yes. Do we do the introduce, make a motion for the bill first, or we do the suspension first? Suspension first, yes.
Thank you. I can move.
Yes, the suspension.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for purposes of moving House Bill 3482, Committee on Ways and Means, absent a fiscal impact statement.
Representative Edwards moves, asks to suspend the rules so that we can consider House Bill 3480 without its fiscal statement and send it to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3480 to the floor with the Duke Pass recommendation. By way of Ways and Means, okay. With a due pass recommendation. With the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Edwards moves House Bill 3480 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and with subsequent referral to the House Ways and Means Committee. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be supporting this bill, but I have I think it's a serious question here and some action I think that we need to take. While I appreciate that these gentlemen and others that may have been members of the Oregon National Guard and that as such we as Oregonians have some obligations to them, I think the primary responsibility for this is the United States Department of Defense. And I would encourage Mr. Chair, that we send some correspondence on to our delegation in Washington, worded as strongly as it can be, to encourage them to rattle the cage with the military departments in this regard.
Thank you very much. Representative Nolan.
Mr. Chair, I concur with the comments from my good friend from Pendleton. But Representative Shields also pointed out that there is another potential responsible party who took a lot of money from the United States military in order to run a safe and efficient and worker-protective operation. And I think I would encourage the Ways and Means to explore the options that he talked about in terms of making sure that they participate in the recompense.
Thank you for that, too. Any other comments? Representative Jensen?
Just so that the good representative and I are on, you know, stay on good terms on this, I wholeheartedly concur with her recommendation on this, and I recognize that there is another possible party that should be held responsible, and anything we can do as a Oregon State Legislature to facilitate in moving that process, I would be most pleased with.
Thank you very much. We have this agreement here. It's very nice. Is there any further discussion with regard to the bill? I will take it upon myself to work with some people to draft a letter to our delegation. At the same time, I will encourage the Ways and Means to consider the amendments that we're looking forward to as well. So with that, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Rowland?
Aye.
Motion passes.
And we'll send it on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you very much for that one. I see I have another representative in the House. And I have my other group still here that's been waiting for about 3 days. Okay, we'll go with House Bill 2345, and we're going to open a public hearing, no, work session. And we need to have the explanations of some amendments that have come to us. So, let's give a short explanation first, and then we'll go from there. So people remember this bill, which we've had.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 2345 requires that health professional licensing boards develop a process to deal with impaired professionals, establishes uniform standards for monitoring impaired professionals, directs health professional licensing boards to impose sanctions on impaired professionals, deletes existing impaired professional programs of specific boards. It applies to licensees identified by health professions licensing boards and disciplinary proceedings commenced on or after January 1, 2010, declares an emergency effective on passage. I believe we have two sets of amendments that have been submitted and are available to you.
Okay. With that, we'll let Representative Maurer explain the set that he has brought to us that should be a compilation of some. So, Representative
Maurer. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Ron Maurer, House District 3. The amendments that I am talking about are the dash 7s. I don't know what else you have. The dash 7s are the mushing together of the dash 5s, which were brought to you by the ACLU, and the dash 6s, which were primarily the Oregon Medical Association. And we have come to a consensus with the ACLU and the Oregon Medical Association that gets them most of the way there. There are still some very, very small concerns. We're hoping that a fiscal will be available during this committee period sometime today, and would urge your adoption of the dash 7s. And
so, any questions for this witness? I do. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Maurer, I haven't had a chance to read the dash 7. You specifically pointed out that they incorporate the dash 5. Is that what I heard correctly? Is that what I heard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, the answer is yes. There was a concern in the original bill about putting fingerprinting into the LEDs, the law enforcement data system, and that language has been removed. Requires self-reporting of any convictions or arrests within 1 business day.
May I follow up?
Yes, please.
Thank you. We also heard testimony the last time we heard this bill from representatives of medical professionals who believed that there were existing very sophisticated programs for dealing with impaired dentists and I can't remember several others. Can you tell me whether this amendment was intended to address their concerns as well?
Not really.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, it was not. And we know that there is some opposition from boards believing, and regardless, that they believe that their programs are sound and do not need to be changed. There are people outside of those professional licensing boards that have a different view and believe that, in fact,
it's not a problem.
But we do know that there are several boards that have had issues with their impaired provider program. And one of the alternatives, in fact, was just to eliminate impaired provider programs altogether. And because we believe that the licensing boards have mission number one, which is protection of the public safety and public interest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. And I do want to make a statement. I got a note from Andrea Meyer who said that the Dash 7s addressed the concerns that they have. So they are happy with it. She couldn't stay here for the meeting, so I appreciate that, too. Any other discussions here? I think what I'm interested in doing is passing the 7 so it's ready to go, and then we have to wait for the fiscal and the other one before we can move it. So we just have a work session on Friday after we get that stuff. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move that the A7 amendments be attached to House Bill 2345.
Representative Berger moves that.
No, it's not.
Not moves.
I move that to adopt, be adopted in House Bill 2345.
Representative Berger, I move to adopt House Bill 2345A-7 amendments dated 5/13/09. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And we will close the work session on...
Before you do that,
yes.
Mr. Chair, just so that you know, I supported moving the Dash A7 amendment into the bill. I'm not sure I'm persuaded, though, that the bill, even with that amendment, will earn my support, so I'm reserving that.
I appreciate that comment. And I think there's others that may be there, too, and we'll check on that between now and Friday. So
we're going to bring it back on Friday.
Yeah. So with that, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2345. And we're going to make sure that we understand we will move this work session to Friday if it's ready to go. So thank you for that one. Let's go to SCR8. I need to send a note around to find out where it is on your own. We're going to open a public hearing on SCR8. And, public hearing on SCR8. We'll have a short explanation.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Concurrent Resolution 8. Memorializes the late Mark Ted Winters, who lived from 1924 to 2008. Mr. Winters worked for the state of Oregon for 15 years, including 7 years as staff to Governors Tom McCall and Bob Straub. He wrote about his early life experiences in the criminal justice system in 2 books, Never Kill Lions, and Lifer. Mr. Winters was married to Senator Jackie Winters.
Thank you for that. And if there's any other people that would like to testify to this bill, they could come up with Representative Berger, but they hadn't signed up. So Representative Berger, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Berger, State Rep, District 20. We all know Senator Winters, and I think most of us in our time here have had contact with Ted, her husband. He is a testimony to the power of redemption in this world. His early history is an interesting one of going down one path in life, one that we wish our young people wouldn't go down. And it, things happened, and he turned his life around and became a model for people who need to turn their lives around, and was a model for people who need to know that it can be done, and devoted really the second half, more than the second half of his life, to other people, and seen that people who had spent their early years in crime, as he did, can change and become models for redemption and giving back to society. He's also just a great, nice man. You just liked Ted on meeting him. This memorial is very appropriate to him. We miss him, and I commend this to you, Mr. Chair, and would sure be honored to carry it if you see to move it forward. Thank you.
Any questions for this witness? Thank you very much. We're going to close our public hearing on SCR 8. We're going to open a work session on SCR 8. And I would love to have a motion.
Sure. That's right. I'm back.
Okay.
I move SCR 8 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Berger moves SCR 8 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Excused?
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Rowland?
Aye.
Motion
passes, and Representative Berger will carry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was the easiest time I've ever had with a committee.
We're going to close.
We can make it more difficult.
We're going to close the work session on SCR 8. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3139. We'll have a short explanation. We've heard this bill many times, and I know there's different people about this bill. We do have a letter that removes the Ways and Means referral because it's down to not costing anything after we've amended it a number of times. And we do have the fiscal and the
revenue.
So with that, I'll leave that to our administrator to give a short explanation.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. House Bill 3139 requires state agencies with an internal auditor to produce at least one complete audit per year. It requires the internal auditor to file a confidential report on the completed internal audit with the Secretary of State. The proposed House Bill 3139-3 amendments replace the original measure. Now requires the, with the amendment, would require agencies of the Executive Department that are required to have an internal audit function to produce a risk assessment of the entire agency conforming to nationally recognized auditing standards. Requires the agency to conduct at least one internal audit per calendar year. Requires agencies to audit a component of its governance and risk management processes at least once every 5 years and file a report with the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. And it requires agencies to file a completed risk assessment or internal audit with the Division of Audits of the Office of the Secretary of State. Various issues have been discussed previously, examples involving a situation where audits might have been helpful, a review of the state internal auditing requirements and procedures as they presently exist, different types of audits, cooperative efforts between the Department of Administrative Services and proponents of the bill, the impact of proposed amendments. We do have fiscal and revenue statements with regard to the Dash 3 amendments indicating no revenue impact. There is a fiscal impact statement.
Okay.
And that should be in your packet.
And we have a letter.
And we do have a letter from the speaker indicating that this referral can be removed.
So with that, I will entertain a motion for the amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated 4-2009 to House Bill 3139.
Representative Edwards moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3139 be adopted dated 4-2009. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the amendments? Seeing none. They are now included.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3139 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves and that the subsequent referral be
Oh, and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Edwards moves House Bill 3139 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Discussion. Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Excuse.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes. Did you want to carry that?
I'll carry it.
Okay. Representative Nolan will carry. And we're going to close our work session on House Bill 3139. And I see Representative Boone here, so we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3487.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to have a short explanation first.
Oh,
and then,
sorry.
Thanks. No
That's
problem.
Right.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. This will be indeed a very short summary. House Bill 3487 modifies the definition of, quote, a child care facility, unquote, in ORS 657A.250 to include preschool, a preschool facility. It also modifies the exclusion from the definition of a child care facility for a facility providing care that is primarily educational.
Okay. And with that, Representative Boone, I think you have an amendment.
I do. And for the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and thank you, Jerry, but I'm going to do something I haven't done in the whole time I've been here. I'm going to offer this amendment, a dash one amendment to 3487, as a gut and stuff. And what this does, this is a really good thing, don't worry. The current language is deleted in a bill that we will be seeing Representative Kotek has that does registration of after-school programs that children go to, and it just changes all those after-schools to preschool. So it's exactly the same bill. They're being done separately because there were, for various reasons, but this was a hole in our system. This, I'll just say, is just what it does is it will result in a requirement that preschools that operate 4 hours or less per day must conduct background checks on their employees and volunteers and be recorded with the child care division in the same manner as is being proposed for certain school-age programs. There are about 380 of these that have been identified, and that's a guess again because they're not registered, they're not known. These are run by various people, and it became clear that a registered pedophile could operate one of these preschools legally as long as it was under 4 hours a day. So I was a little astounded by that, as you can imagine, and wanted to make sure that we did something about that. And I know the Commission on Children and Families are doing, have done a big survey, and they wanted to address this next. And this takes care of this in a way. Right now, it doesn't require them to certify. It just requires them to be noted and recorded, and they have to do background checks. And these are people who do these preschools as a business. So this will take care of the 6,000 children, estimated 6,000 children in these programs that have no oversight right as at present. And the amendment does is treats it just like the after-school programs. It makes it's a $20 fee, so you don't have a fiscal yet, I don't believe.
No.
It'll be a $20 fee for them to get their background check and be recorded, if you will. The child care division will then meet with these people, and they can let them know if you should want to go further and become certified. Here are the advantages you will see with that program. And that's a much more rigorous requirement there. But they do then qualify for some of the benefits and their monetary benefits that can happen. And it would be up to them at that point. But we wanted a way that we could capture these businesses and protect these children. It's very simple.
Questions for this witness? Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, apologies. Reb Boone, I can't find the amendment in this pack of stuff, and I haven't seen it. So explain to me, there somebody It's in front of me. Oh, that's the wrong one. Yeah, that's okay. You can explain this. Does it define someone as anyone paid for childcare less than... how does it...
There are 8 or 9 pages of explanations.
Well, then I'm probably asking a pretty complicated...
And they talk about basically school-age children, preschool, you know, the facility, blah, 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 8 hours. That's different. This just covers a preschool. These are under 4 hours a day. I went to...
Is it intended, I guess, Mr. Chair, can I pursue this a minute? Because I'm trying to... Is it intended for anybody who's being paid to babysit somebody else's kid?
No. This is for a preschool. It's primarily educational activities.
I thought those were already...
No, they are. Under 4 hours a day. Over 4 hours a day, they must be registered.
That's unbelievable.
I know.
I just thought...
I know. We heard about this in committee on another bill completely, and then... Representative Kotek has put forward a bill, and I don't recall the number. It's not down there. Anyway.
2987.
Yeah. Somebody said 2987. Could they be right?
Okay,
a voice from out of somewhere.
Anyway, we that's the bill that does exactly the same thing for the after-school programs. My own granddaughter is in one, and it became clear to me that even though it was held in the school building, and I just would assume that would be a school-sanctioned program, they're completely separate, and when I went to pick her up, nobody asked who I was, nobody checked. I could have taken 3 kids. So anyway, it was a little astonishing, and when I mentioned it to other people, they said, oh no, if they're in the school, they have to be checked out, and it's not true. So... if Tom is going to come and testify, he can probably give you fine details.
He didn't sign up, but he could if he would like to. And Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The dynamic trio back there.
Representative Boone,
yes.
How much is $20 enough to conduct a background check? And who conducts it?
See, now that's where we need these guys.
Okay,
there she is. All right. Thank you. Good for your back.
Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Hines. I'm the legal and compliance manager with the Child Care Division. In answer to your question, under the amendments, the organization, the preschool itself, would be required to conduct a background check. I mean, either through their local police department or however they chose to do that. So that would not be a cost to the state. The $20 would be intended to pay for the cost of the division recording the program, keeping it, maintaining a database so that individuals would know who's out there.
Thank you. Other questions of these witnesses? And I do appreciate the second page of the bill, which is a list of people who are not included, all the relatives. It's an interesting way of doing it, but I think it's what you have to do. I don't know that there's any other way. My wife ran a daycare facility for a long time, but it was longer, so it was registered. It was the 8-hour variety.
That's different.
Yeah,
and
I know.
She's perfect, so.
Yeah. but we found the same things. There's very, very few regulations for setting up short-time daycare, especially the after-school ones. And Kotek's bill only, I think, covered those that were in schools, right? Didn't affect...
School-age. Hers are school-age and after the so-called after-school programs. And some are held in schools, and then some are held in community centers and wherever.
So this one takes care of the gap between birth and school-age. Is that what this would do?
This also, and Kathleen probably knows this better, it's just these are the less than 4 hours a day preschools... And so under school age and, you know, either in a place or in a home or some, you know, they're located somewhere.
Okay. Very good. Representative? No, we don't have any of the amendments just came out. So we were hoping we would get them a little sooner and we would be able to have those things. But so my intention right now is to close this hearing and move the work session to Friday, and we'll try to hopefully have all that stuff by then.
Friday, yeah. We just got them today, too.
Yes, I do want to move the amendments. Okay. So with that, thank you very much, and we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3487, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 3487.
Mr.
Representative Berger.
I move that the Dash 1 amendments be adopted into House Bill 3487.
Representative Berger moves the Dash 1 amendments dated 5-13-09 to House Bill 3487 be adopted. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And we'll close the work session on 3487, and that will and we'll work with Jerry to try to get the materials we need so we can move that bill ahead.
And we're scheduling it for Friday.
Okay. We're actually moving through this agenda. Next on the agenda, open a public hearing on House Bill 3484. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3484 requires facilitators of like-kind exchanges to make certain modifications and provide bonds or other securities in specified amounts. It defines an exchange facilitator as well as other terms for purposes of the Act, prohibits an exchange facilitator from taking certain actions, creates a private right of action for damages creates a private right of action on bonds or deposits described in the measure for damages suffered, and sunsets January 2nd, 2014.
Okay. And we have no one signed up, so I'm assuming... I want to look at this real quickly. Hmm. And I had talked to somebody earlier. Oh. Escobar and Riley, they're not here. Okay, so I see no one to testify for this bill, so I'm going to close the work session and we'll decide if they want this bill in the future.
Close the public hearing.
Close the public hearing. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3484. And we will, at some point, if we get some information to move this bill, we'll have to reschedule it. But now we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2853. And with that, we'll have a short explanation.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, House Bill 2853 expands the prohibition on possessing and transferring a firearm to include a person found guilty, except for insanity, of a misdemeanor. Requires a psychiatric security review board and judicial department to provide state police with access to specific records and information identifying persons who have been committed or have been found guilty or guilty except by reason of insanity of a crime. Creates a procedure for requesting relief from the prohibition on owning or possessing firearms. This is previously been before the House Judiciary Committee, which moved the bill without recommendation as to passage and be referred to rules. I can go into some background if you wish.
That's fine for right now. We'll let the other people do that. So with that, we're going to call up David Yandell and Joe O'Leary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Joe O'Leary, Senior Policy Advisor for Public Safety Issues for Governor Ted Kulongoski. The bill before you has a Dash 3 amendment, which is, I think, the relevant document for consideration. And I'm going to give you just a few minutes of context to describe why it was that the Governor's Office and the Oregon State Police fixated on this particular bill and its relating clause to insert the Dash 3 amendment. it actually takes you back, the context actually takes you back 2 years to the Virginia Tech shootings, which I'm sure you all remember. In the aftermath of the Virginia Tech shootings, Congress passed a law that required the states to tighten up the types of mental health adjudication information that they report to a national database. And the purpose behind that was to make sure that accurate information about who is currently prohibited under federal law from possessing firearms would be conveyed at the time of a sale of a firearm. Shortly after Congress passed that legislation, we also discovered that Oregon was one of a handful of states, I believe five states in the country, that transmitted no mental health information to the federal database, none whatsoever. When the governor found that out, he was extremely concerned, and he asked me to work with state police to figure out what we could do to fix that. And state police, through David Yandell sitting to my left, convened a work group involving the Department of Justice, state police, the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Judicial Department, and they took as many administrative steps as they could to begin reporting the mental health adjudication to the federal government. But there was only so far they could go administratively, and as I mentioned earlier, this bill presented the perfect relating clause for us to insert some of the statutory requirements that are required by the federal law. This does really two things. One is the reporting piece, and it provides specific statutory authorization for state entities to report mental health adjudication information to the federal database. That information falls into three categories: a civil commitment, an aid and assist, that is a finding that a person is unable to proceed in a criminal trial, and finally a finding of guilty except for insanity. All of those require a court order, a court adjudication. And the other thing I want to say about the bill is that it's the dash three, is it's specific that the information that gets transmitted to the federal government is not the psychological record, it's not the diagnosis information, it's basically name, date of birth, gender, identifiers, it's the minimal amount of information. So that's the reporting element of the Dash 3. The other element of this is the relief from the prohibition. As I mentioned, there's a federal prohibition of several categories of individuals that are prohibited under federal law from possessing firearms. For the record, the Dash 3 does nothing to expand those prohibitions. This doesn't take away the right of anybody who currently can possess a firearm to do so. But what the relief provision does, and this is required by the federal act, is it creates a process in the state in order for people who have been civilly committed, found unable to aid and assist, or guilty except for insanity, to seek to have their rights to possess a firearm restored so that they can legally possess a gun. There are two issues that have to do with grants that are collateral to this bill, not mentioned in the bill, but I want to bring it up. One is there's going to be an expense in implementing this. If you decide to move it forward. And the federal government, along with the mandate to have states comply, has promised funding, at least for the first year, to help states comply. And our hope is that that's going to continue. The other thing the federal government has done doesn't look like a carrot, but looks more like a stick, and they have said that if the states don't comply, the penalty will be a reduction in our Justice Assistance Grant, also known as BURN Grant. That's federal public safety, federal dollars that come to the states in a block grant that can be used to fund, and in Oregon are used to fund drug courts, are used to fund multi-jurisdictional enforcement teams, and other victim services, a broad array of purposes. So that's the two things the bill does, the carrot and the stick, and hopefully that gives you the detail. Mr. Yandell knows the detail of the bill and knows the detail of the federal law in a way that I can only hope to. So he's here if you have technical questions, and I'm happy to answer any easy questions that you have.
Did you have any regular testimony or just questions, Mr. Yandell?
Mr. Chair, I do have testimony to
go ahead first, and we'll ask questions of both of you, so go okay. Forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Yandell. I'm the director of the Law Enforcement Information Division for the Oregon State Police. I'd like to begin by offering some background to the federal law and the program that we're trying to support. The National Instant Criminal Background Check System, or NICS, was mandated by Congress as part of the 1993 Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act of 1993. Implemented on November the 3rd of 1998, NICS is a computerized system operated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is designed to immediately determine if a person is disqualified from transporting, shipping, receiving, or possessing firearms under federal law. Under federal law, federal firearm licensees are required to contact NICS before transferring a firearm to an unlicensed person to obtain information on whether the person is subject to a federally imposed firearm ban. Currently, federal law prohibits 10 types of individuals who have been adjudicated as mentally ill or who have been involuntarily committed to a state mental institution by either a state court, board, agency, or commission. I might add that in the state of Oregon, there are 1,500 federally licensed firearm dealers, which are required by federal law to abide by the federal law. In light of the shootings at Virginia Tech in April of 2007, Congress passed the NICS Improvement Amendments Act of 2007, or we refer to as the NIAA. The NIAA is intended to improve the information available to NICS to enable the NICS system to more accurately identify persons who are subject to a federally imposed firearm ban. The NIAA accomplishes this by requiring the states to first estimate the number of records in its databases that correspond to the 10 types of persons barred under federal law from shipping, transporting, receiving, or possessing firearms. Under the NIAA, states are required to transmit certain percentages of the state's initial estimate to NICS within certain timelines or risk losing a portion of funding allocated to the state under the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 1968. Among its various provisions, the NIAA also authorizes grant programs to support states in their efforts to improve the quality and completeness of records submitted to NICS. On March the 11th of 2009, President Obama signed the FY Omnibus Appropriations Act, which allocated $10 million for the National Criminal History Improvement Program, or NCHIP grant, to the states, as well as an additional $10 million of NIAA grants to the states. Under the terms of the NIAA, in order for states to qualify for NICS Improvement Act grant funds, states must first provide the United States Department of Justice with reasonable estimates of certain categories of available records contained in the state's databases over the last 20 years that correspond to the types of persons subject to a federally imposed firearm ban. States were required to submit the estimation of available records to the United States Department of Justice by May the 1st of 2009. Oregon has met that requirement. And you all have a summary sheet of our initial estimate that on the left column illustrates the number of records that we've identified in the state repository, and in the right-hand column, the number of records that we've identified that reside either at the PSRB, the Psychiatric Security Review Board, the Department of Human Services, Health and Mental Health and Addictions Unit, or the Oregon Department of Justice, the Oregon Judicial Department, the state courts. Included in the required record estimates are estimates of records whereby an individual has been adjudicated as mentally ill or who has been involuntarily committed to a state mental institution by either a state court, board, agency, or commission. Additionally, states must also certify to the satisfaction of the United States Attorney General that the state has implemented a relief from disabilities program that permits persons who have been adjudicated as mentally ill or who have been involuntarily committed to a state mental institution by either a state court, board, agency, or commission to apply for relief from a federal firearm ban that occurs as a result of such an adjudication or commitment. Certification of a state's implementation of a relief from disabilities program is due on June the 22nd of 2009. I provided you all with a copy of the certification form that we are required to complete and submit by June the 22nd. State efforts, and Mr. O'Leary shared with you the direction that we received early last year, but in November of 2007, and coinciding with the congressional adoption of the NIAA, you know, the Oregonian ran an article that stated Oregon was one of several states not providing mental health records. When we investigated that claim, we determined that it was, in fact, correct. We determined that the state was not forwarding mental health records to NICS as required under the NIAA, and subsequently formed a multi-agency work group consisting of the Oregon State Police, the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Judicial Department, and the Oregon Department of Justice, which worked together to identify the legal impediments and tasks required to ensure Oregon's compliance with the NIAA. I might add that we have learned that as of December of this last year, the state of Oregon has a total of 4 records in the National Instant Check system today. 3 of those are for domestic violence, and 1 of them is for a mental health prohibition. So you can see, based on the estimates that we just recently completed prior to the 1st of May, that we have a significant number of records that are missing from the national database. On April the 8th of 2009, a public hearing on House Bill 2853 was held in House Judiciary. At that time, we introduced the -1 amendments, and I'm sure you probably already understood that this is a gut and stuff of 2853. So any of the existing language in 2853 would come out, and in its place, we're proposing the -3 amendment. At that time, we introduced the -1 amendments. Subsequent to that hearing and after a number of meetings with our stakeholders, which has now grown to include the Psychiatric Security Review Board, the Oregon Psychiatric Association, Disability Rights Oregon, the National Rifle Association, the Oregon Firearms Federation, and the American Civil Liberties Union, and the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the -2 amendments were drafted. Additional input from our stakeholders and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms recently have resulted in the -3 amendments you have before you. So those really are the culmination of work over the past few months aimed at trying to establish an absolute minimal requirement to meet the federal law. The -3 amendments to House Bill 2853 are designed to amend Oregon's current Relief from Disabilities Program contained in ORS 166-274, as well as improve OSP's access to qualifying mental health records that are in the databases of the Oregon Judicial Department, the Oregon Department of Human Services, and the Oregon Psychiatric Review Board. Before I move into the section-by-section overview of the -3 amendments, would you have any questions?
Any questions yet for these people?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to ask to be excused.
Oh, that's right. Committee. You guys have to go to Ways and Means. That's true. Okay, that would be fine. I think we're okay so far. So let's go through a short...
Mr. Chair, may I am also going to have to ask to be excused,
fine.
At least in about 5 minutes. I have an appointment with the Public Safety Sub co-chairs.
Okay.
Thank you.
That will be fine. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to be respectful of your time, I'll try to give an overview and not go into a whole lot of detail. Mr. Herb Lovejoy, our attorney from the Department of Justice is present. If you have any specific questions that are of a legal nature, I'm unfortunately not an attorney, but Mr. Lovejoy will be, I'm sure, more than happy to assist us in answering any specific legal questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you.
Section 1 of the -3 amendments specifically addresses the ability of the Department of State Police to acquire the needed information.
Oh.
Can I ask one question?
Yes.
It essentially is the -3 a gut and stuff of everything, so that when I read through, that will be the bill.
That's the whole
we'll
thing.
Working
yeah.
with. Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's correct. Not a problem.
Section 1 of the -3 amendment specifically addresses the desired information that resides at the Department of Human Services, the the Psychiatric Security Review Board, the Oregon Judicial Department, and authorizes those agencies to provide the information to the state police, which would subsequently be provided to the FBI into the National Instant Check System. You'll note that we have specifically developed a definition of minimal information. Accessing sensitive mental health information and medical information of individuals. Again, as Mr. O'Leary mentioned, the minimal information that the FBI is looking for is the name, date of birth, and sex of the individual. And if we have the Social Security number and are willing to share it for identification purposes, they'd like to have that information as well, but it's not required. Section 2, the proposed Dash 3 amendments are specifically aimed at ensuring that ORS 426-160 conforms to the requirements of Section 1 of the bill, again, specifically relating to our ability to acquire the information, and specifically that we're looking at minimally necessary information. Section 3, the proposed Dash 3 amendments in Section 3 are amendments that conform ORS 427-293 to the requirements of Section 1 of the bill. And again, in part, the sections in the Dash 3 amendments are aimed at lining up the statute to facilitate OSP's ability to acquire the information which would subsequently be provided to the FBI. Section 4 are conforming amendments that amend ORS 166-412 and delete current subsection 8 of existing Oregon law. The existing law requires DHS to provide the Department of State Police with direct electronic access to information in DHS's database. That capability already exists under state law. Section 8 of 166-412 would be removed specifically to make sure that it's in line with Section 1 of the Dash 3 amendments. Section 5, the proposed Dash 3 amendments would authorize persons who, as a result of an Oregon mental health determination, adjudication, or commitment, are subject to a federal ban on shipping, transporting, possessing, or receiving firearms to seek relief. Again, as Mr. O'Leary mentioned early on, one of the provisions of the NICS Improvement Amendments Act is that each state create a relief from prohibition for those mental health-related criteria that are a cause for prohibiting a person from possessing or purchasing a firearm. Prior to the Improvement Act's adoption in January of last year, those prohibitions were considered lifetime. So the Act now allows each of the states to create a relief from that prohibition. Section 6, again, is a conforming amendment to ensure that the existing individuals under ORS 166-470 that are subject to a state firearm ban continue with the existing disabilities provision under current law. Section 7, again, is a conforming amendment that amends ORS 166-274, specifically allows relief provision for juveniles. Section 8 of the Dash 3 amendments clarifies that the new information reporting requirement placed on DHS, the PSRB, and the Judicial Department all specifically relies on the availability of federal funding that we are hoping to achieve through the grant that's due May the 22nd. In Section 9, the last section of the bill, is a sunset provision that would specifically address a concern made by the Psychiatric Security Review Board that if federal funding went away, they do not have the resources to provide the hearings that are proposed under the Dash 3 amendments. And I'm sure you'll be hearing specifically from Mary Claire Buckley on her concerns regarding that particular provision. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Representative? Counselor.
I had a couple, if that okay.
Yes, please.
On your written testimony, you talked about the development of of the Dash amendments, and you listed all of the folks that came into meeting with you after the Dash ones. Do the Dash 3 amendments address the concerns of, for example, Disability Rights Oregon, the Oregon Firearms Federation?
Chair Roblin, Representative Gelser, unfortunately, this issue is one that I would doubt seriously that we could anticipate that we would all ultimately agree. We have some individuals, and I don't want to speak for them, but members of our work group, which I'm sure you'll hear from yet this afternoon, who have philosophical differences about the entire program that the FBI runs and the federal law. Currently, as you know, it's state law that those wishing to purchase a firearm in the state of Oregon have to go through our own firearms instant check system, which includes checking many of the databases within the state of Oregon, seeking information to determine if the individual should be prohibited from purchasing a firearm, much like what the federal government is trying to do at the federal level. Currently, if an individual from the state of Oregon were to try to purchase a firearm out of state, that state is required to check NICS. And as I mentioned before, we only have four records for the state of Oregon in place today. So they would be lacking a large amount of information on which to base their decision whether to allow the person to purchase.
And I'm sorry that my questions aren't better formed. I was more comfortable with this bill this morning, frankly, before I read the materials that are provided to us here at the hearing. I understand the intent of the federal law and actually support the idea that we don't want violent criminals or individuals that have a violent past to be able to purchase firearms. What I have difficulty understanding is how you get around, is it a philosophical difference or is it actually a constitutional question whether a person, by virtue of being a person with mental retardation or by virtue of being a person with mental illness, is now going to have one of their constitutional rights taken away from them? And I find that deeply, deeply troubling. Again, I think there's a difference between individuals that have those circumstances who have been convicted of doing something wrong, but why would we immediately assume that a person with mental retardation or a person with mental illness who has never committed a crime but may have been civilly committed because they were unable to care for themselves and they needed to be committed so that they could have adequate food and shelter, why is it appropriate to take a constitutional right away from those folks on the basis of their disability?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I'm not sure that I can answer that that question. Our primary thrust has been to determine where the gaps exist between the federal law and the requirement that passed in January of last year and existing Oregon law. Our work group last year struggled initially trying to get a handle on all of the different statutory criteria under Oregon law that met the federal law criteria. And so that was one of the first steps that we did, was to work through a crosswalk of the federal law and the state counterpart to make sure that we understood which records that were already existing of those individuals that are already prohibited. To give you a little idea as far as numbers are concerned, if it helps, last year in the state of Oregon, there were 163,000 transactions through the firearms unit here in Oregon. These are firearms transactions or mm-hmm. purchase requests in the state. We had 2,170 denials, and many of those were for convicted felons attempting to purchase firearms. There were those with 456 were individuals that were on probation. They're prohibited from purchasing a firearm. So from our perspective, the numbers show that there is a need for someone to scrutinize those purchases to ensure public safety.
And follow up, I don't dispute that at all. What I do dispute is why would we take a constitutional right away from someone that has never done anything wrong? I mean, is there a problem that we're trying to address in the state of Oregon? Have you had a rash of people with Down syndrome trying to buy guns and harm people, and therefore we need to take all their data and put it in a database?
Chair Roman, Representative Gelser, again, that certainly isn't our intent, but if it falls under the federal law, then our current desire is to make sure that we're complying with the federal law.
I have a follow-up question along that line. As the Dash 3s are written, are the professional people who have their duty to take care of or to treat these mentally ill people, are they making the decision and then just giving the names to the state police? Or are the state, are they having to give information to the state police for them to make the decision? If these people back here are making a decision as to which of those people, I feel a little more comfortable. I mean, I want my professional people, because I think I have the same concern that Representative Gelser has. If they don't believe this person has any reason to be put on the list, they won't put them on the list. But so as I read this, I'm thinking now that this more clearly states that the professionals make the decision. And that's what I want to find out from you. Is that what these do?
Mr. Chair, that certainly is the intent. The state police is not the decision maker. The professional body that has the expertise to make that evaluation are the state courts. They determine if the person meets the criteria. We just need the name and for what purpose that individual has been deemed prohibited.
We'll ask some others. There's certain those others are coming, but
can
I agree
just follow
with
up on
absolutely.
That? Absolutely. I think the issue that I have, and I appreciate that, the place where the professionals make the decision, there's nothing in here about a planning group that sits down and determines the relative safety of an individual, which, again, for you or I, who don't have a mental illness or a developmental disability, we're just trusted to not do bad things. And if we do bad things, we will be held accountable. What this says is that if an individual is civilly committed, that becomes the trigger. One of the reasons you can become civilly committed if you're a person with a developmental disability is that you're the victim of abuse. The state comes on and they civilly commit you for your own safety. So now you have a victim that you've taken, you've civilly committed them, and you've taken a constitutional right away. And in just reading through the overview, there is an ability for a person who's under the jurisdiction of the PSRB who has been found guilty except for insanity to come back and seek relief from that ban. There is no, at least not in the summary, why is there no opportunity to seek relief for a person with mental retardation who had been civilly committed for doing nothing that was within their control?
Other than they couldn't take care of themselves.
Other than that they couldn't take care of themselves or that somebody was abusing them, and that's the right. Only way to get that. I'm just deeply concerned with stealing the constitutional rights away from an already vulnerable population.
We can have your attorney, if you would, yeah. Is that who you'd like to have come up?
Mr. Chair, I'm hoping that maybe I'm missing something here in your question. I believe I understand it, but again, our assumption has been from the very beginning that these individuals who are prohibited under Oregon law, somebody has already made the determination that they're prohibited, and they have the records on that individual. All we're wanting and asking for is that information to be passed on to the next system. We're not making a judgment. There already is a relief provision under Oregon law today for prohibitions under the Oregon revised statutes. That provision does not apply to the federal prohibition. So that's another component part of the Dash 3 is the creation of the relief provision. And as a component part of that, and just to illustrate our commitment to making sure that the professionals who should know, presumably, are hearing folks and are receiving their challenge is one of the reasons why we chose the PSRB as the most likely state organization or board to make that determination. And I'm sure Mary Claire would have some thoughts and concerns as well to share on that.
And I think that would be helpful. There's a distinction, though. People with mental retardation that haven't committed crimes are not under the jurisdiction of the PSRB. Mental retardation and mental illness are totally different things diagnostically, and they also come from two totally different service systems. And I'm concerned that this does not reflect that.
And you'll be around, so we can call you back if we need to.
Absolutely.
Any other questions right now? And then I will bring some of those other people.
I appreciate your taking my questions. I was just taken by surprise and... So thank you for being patient with the questions.
You're welcome.
So we'll go back to order here. Kevin Sarrett and Rod Harder, come on up.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Starrett with the Oregon Firearms Federation. As I'm sure you guys realize, this bill is very different than it was even yesterday. And
yes.
A little hard to absorb all of it. Some of you have already touched on what our concerns are. Our concerns principally, and it's different than it has been. Essentially, we've had long and very, very positive conversations with the state police, not only on this, but on other issues going back 8 or 9 months, and they've always been extremely professional and extremely courteous, and I understand why they feel they need to do this. But the reason I originally met with the state police ID unit going back months was because we have been hearing from a very large number of people who are being delayed on firearms purchases, sometimes denied, for no real cause because the system itself is so imperfect. And our philosophical objection to this is that it's an expansion of a system that we don't believe currently functions well at all to begin with, and with that comes an enormous potential for confusion and abuses now that new records are being put into a system which already currently delays a lot of people. Now, the state police have gone a long way towards fixing some of the problems that we came to them with. For example, at one time, purchasers were being told that in the absence of an approval, they were not allowed to take possession of the gun until the state police said they could, which is not what the law says. The law says after 3 days have elapsed, they can have it. But the state police were informing both buyers and sellers that that was not the case. And my understanding is that's been addressed very, very seriously. But the problem still exists. And one of the problems that we've had is that not all states are very cooperative when this ID unit attempts to get information about a buyer. And one of the states that we've had a lot of trouble with, and I believe the state police will affirm this because they've told me this, is California. California is very uncooperative in terms of supplying information that would relieve somebody of these prohibitions. My understanding, in having spoken to Mr. Yandell earlier, is that California does not plan to cooperate with this bill. And as has been pointed out, what we're trying to do here is get in compliance with a federal bill, H.R. 2640, which was signed by George Bush after the Virginia Tech attack. What I find ironic about it is that the purported intention of H.R. 2640, which we opposed, as did many state organizations, It was done to prevent mentally defective people from buying guns, particularly from one state to another. But the shooter in Virginia Tech bought his guns in Virginia, and he had a long history of aberrant behavior and a long history of being noticed by people that there was something wrong with him, and the mental health professionals that we would now task with deciding whether or not a person is competent and eligible to have a gun did not notice what was wrong with this guy. I mean, every sign was there. And so we don't really believe that this necessarily is going to address a problem. What we do believe is that by taking a whole new group of records, which may be properly used, may be improperly used, and turning them over to, in this case, the FBI, which, quite frankly, has not done a particularly good job of administering a program which we didn't believe was constitutionally correct in the first place, we don't really believe that that is going to be a positive thing for anybody. And the intention is clear. The intention is not only we don't believe in complying, we oppose the law, we don't believe in complying with the law, but we know the state police are trying to achieve something that is certainly a reasonable thing to try to achieve. We just don't believe that this is going to get us there, especially considering that the problem that caused this bill to be drafted and signed into law wouldn't have been fixed had H.R. 2640, which we're trying to comply with, been in effect at the time of the Virginia Tech shootings. Nothing would have changed.
Thank you very much. Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder. I'm the Oregon consultant for the National Rifle Association. This bill, as many of you know, It started off with the dash ones being horrid, turned into awful with the dash twos, and almost getting there with the dash threes. So there has been some progress in working with the state police, and I've worked with them for 20-odd years. This has been a much calmer and reasoned approach than they've taken in a lot of different circumstances. We still have some problems with the bill. First, I'd like to address Representative Gelser's question, because that is, and I will read you what my counsel wrote about the dash ones, and that certainly changed. But being mentally ill or retarded is not, under federal law, automatically the same as being a mental defective, which requires a more specific findings that a person, as a result of marked subnormal intelligence or mental illness, is incompetency, condition, or disease, is a danger to himself or others, or lacks the mental capacity to contact or manage his own affairs. And then they go on to say how we get around this by having a judge in the court make a determination that the person would be prohibited under federal law before that proclamation is made. So there is a fix to your concern, and I think it should be included in the bill if it's not already. We look at Section 2, and it says that the court shall comply with rules made by Oregon State Police. This seems a little bit out of the ordinary to me that we have a court complying with an agency's rulemaking process. If that's acceptable or not, that's a question for the committee to decide. And I have talked to David about that, and they're working with the courts. But it does seem a little backwards to me that that would be the way things were progressing. We find in Section 5C10 on page 9 that they say that you can only appeal this every 5 years.
Of the dash threes.
Of the dash threes, okay. Yes. Page 9 of the dash threes. we think that that's a little bit lengthy between opportunities to appeal, right? And I asked the state police about that, and they said it was a budgetary thing. And like this bill, which actually they're not complied, the Oregon states are not obligated to comply with the federal law. They just don't get any money if they don't. And so I don't think doing away with money is a good idea in this budgetary climate. But at the same time, I don't think it should be the driving force in passing legislation. We got the amendments to this bill when we walked in at 1500. I would sincerely appreciate the opportunity to get them to my counsel. They are familiar with the federal law. As Mr. Sterrett said, it's pretty confusing if you try to read it and understand it. And I don't want to pass legislation on a law we don't understand without seeing how it's going to fit in. So with that, I'd answer any questions that I might be able to.
Any questions for either of these witnesses? And I do appreciate the fact that you just got these. We just got them as well. But I appreciate that the police are working at it. And actually, I agree with your assessment that these are much better than the ones before. But we need to look at them. And we won't be moving it today, but because I do want to give some people a little bit. We probably will reschedule it. But I want to see where we're at and how people are going. I had some earlier concerns from the ACLU that lined up exactly with where you guys are, which is kind of interesting as well.
It's all the time.
That's what I was saying. So, and they're not here, so I'm hoping that that indicates maybe that they are closer for them as well than the others. But I would really, personally, I think we need to try to figure out a fix that can really work and not put people in jeopardy, especially people who have done nothing wrong. But I'm not in a rush to do that if we do it badly. So it is my goal to do it right and to get people who can work together to continue to get it to the point where it's the best bill it can be in this period of time. So I'll keep working on that. Yes.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify the concern. I think people could rightly make the argument if you are a person who has a cognitive disability that maybe it's not a good idea for you to be using a firearm or to be owning a firearm. However, It's one thing to have that individual and the people around that individual support them to make that decision. It's a very slippery slope to take a population of people and to start just proactively taking rights away from them. I think a great example would be my brother got married. We were all down in Colorado, and everybody was going to the shooting range to shoot guns, because that's what you do at a shooting range, to celebrate. And my son was invited to go along, my 7-year-old daughter who has a developmental disability. He had the right to go along, but my daughter, before I had the chance, said, I think that would be a really bad idea. So he stayed behind and did not go. And I think we can trust people to have the reasonable judgment to make those kinds of decisions rather than making it illegal for them to have choices.
And I would say on the same idea, different side, I have a really good friend who has a Down syndrome child who's now in his 30s, I think, who has always been a hunter with his father, and that has been a major part of the bonding between the parent and the son, and they did lots of things together, and one of them was to do this appropriately. And I don't know that I could find a safer person than that young man who could tell you every one of the statutes and rules and abides by every single one of them. I agree, and it depends on the family and the structure and what's been happening. So I share that concern. So thank you both, and I don't see any other questions. And we have Mary Claire Buckby and John McCauley. I think I saw John. Yep, he's there. And these are our last two witnesses, unless anybody else is out there waiting with bated breath to come forward and testify on this bill. Okay. And thank you both for being here. And
thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Robles, members of the committee, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Because of its importance, Barry Cass, the chair of the adult panel, had hoped to testify on this bill, but due to longstanding vacation plans, he was unavailable today, and so has asked me to share the board's comments and initial concerns that they had expressed when first learning of this. As Mr. Yandell noted, the board was not involved in the discussions or drafting of this bill until just 3 weeks ago. I was made aware of the reporting provision of this bill by our own Assistant Attorney General sometime before that, but we did not have any problems with that provision because the identity of persons under the Psychiatric Security Review Board is already a public record. And so that in itself was not problematic to the board, although some language in the initial dash one raised a question. However, with the clarifications that have been made in the dash threes regarding the definition of minimally necessary information, the board would not oppose that part of the bill. However, it is the second and larger part of this legislation that caused the board some consternation, as you might imagine. As I mentioned, the first I heard of this proposal that the board assumed the responsibility of these relief hearings was on the afternoon of April 16th, at which time I was invited to a meeting the next morning. After attending that meeting and learning what this would entail and considering the tremendous ramifications of this concept on the current operations and functioning of the board, I immediately called for an emergency administrative meeting of both the adult and juvenile panels of the board to consider this. And that occurred the following Monday evening. And that was the first time my board members had heard of this bill as well. As you might imagine, the initial response by members was mixed. Some expressed that conducting such relief hearings falls outside the scope of the mission, that that's basically not what they signed up for, and had some concerns that this might discourage other prospective members in the future from when you mix both of these functions, that it might well discourage future members from being interested in serving on the board. However, there were others that could understand that this did involve an issue of public safety and that assigning this responsibility to the board represented a vote of confidence, if you will, or respect for the board's capacity to make such judgments, actually serving as an indirect complement to the board in some ways. They felt, in addition, that the assignment seemed to be a logical solution to a genuine problem, that is, finding an entity with the expertise and experience to decide such matters and whose members and staff could protect the privacy of the mental health information that would become part of the record, although all agreed that firearms and the restrictions surrounding them are not an area of the board expertise at this point. But beyond the philosophical, there were some pragmatic concerns voiced. In contrast to the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, the PSRB members only serve on a part-time basis. By statute, as you might know, each panel is comprised of a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a parole or probation officer, a member of the general public, and an attorney. And all of them have full-time professional responsibilities within which they must fit the PSRB hearing duties. At least for the adult panel at this point, demands on their time already represent a major problem. The issue of additional demand on the board's members' time is compounded by the fact that no one has a clue how this will shake down. We are, as you might say, wading into rather uncharted waters. The number of cases that might be required is not quantifiable at this point, but could be quite substantial in the initial months or years, given that the data that we've received from the state police indicate that the mental health prohibitors, which is the group that the board would be responsible for addressing these relief hearings, totals more than 61,000 records at this point. But the board's greatest and most critical concern of all is having the necessary personnel resources. The staff of this agency is already maxed out, to be perfectly frank, and anyone involved in our system from the governor's office on down will attest to that. We have had a study conducted by the Budget and Management Office as well as the HRSD Human Resources, and who found that the board is in need of four additional FTEs just to do the job it currently has. The governor's recommended budget acknowledged that even in these dire fiscal times by at least recommending one additional FTE. So the board's position at this point would be that they cannot and would not be able to perform this added responsibility unless given the additional staffing and funding necessary to operate this separate and apart from its current program for the guilty except for insanity, because the present staff cannot assume one more duty. Having shared that position with Mr. Yandell and Mr. Lovejoy, I'm pleased that the Dash 3 included language that makes this process contingent upon the receipt of adequate funding. But having said all that, the board also has come to recognize through the discussions with the governor's office and Mr. Yandell and the rest of the work group of the importance of this legislation, not only to the governor, to the state, and to the state police. It acknowledges the need for some board or commission to handle these at the initial level to assure that the two-step appellate review required by the federal government could be attained. Although the board wasn't looking for more work, I can assure you, if this committee determines that this role fits best and should lie with the Psychiatric Security Review Board, it would request a couple of things. First, obviously, that the legislature authorize the FTE deemed necessary to staff the startup and ongoing operation of this new endeavor and the use of other funding for the attendant costs associated, including the stipends for board members, information technology, because we'll need a separate database, services and supplies, attorney general billing, training for board members, rent, and the like, which will likely, at least initially, come from the federal grant designed for this purpose that you heard about. Secondly, the board had sought an acknowledgement that this should not become an unfunded mandate, and that if the federal dollars were to disappear and the state were not in a position to step up and fund this operation, the board could cease conducting these hearings. This appears to now have been addressed in Section 10 of the Dash 3 and with the sunset provision, and I appreciate that effort and change. And finally, the board would ask for permission to return to the appropriate committee if our initial stabs at the projected costs and hearing needs end up being way off base. As I said, given the newness of this, and not only to Oregon but to the state, there is no one to look for to see, for guidance in this endeavor. No one has any idea whether there'll be one request or 1,000 requests. We are obviously hopeful that it will be closer to the former rather than the latter, and frankly, the board's fiscal impact statement reflects closer to the former. But it is the unknown of all this that causes the board some concern, as I'm sure you might understand. So I thank you for this opportunity to share those thoughts of the board and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCulley. I'm here representing Oregon Psychiatric Association. We have long been concerned about the stigmatization of people with mental disorders, and this issue seems to concentrate that stigmatization, and that is, I think, a bigger issue. I guess one of my proudest moments was being yelled at by Speaker Katz many years ago for trying to make sure that people with mental disorders had the same ability to purchase firearms as anybody else. At the same time, we understand the federal law that is in play here and have appreciated the work of the Oregon State Police in bringing folks together to talk about these issues. In the Dash 3 amendments, we appreciate the language that appears on page 2, which is subsection 4 of section 1, lines 15 through 25. The issue that we brought to the discussion was the fact that we did not want to see the medical records be considered a part of whatever records were going to be collected. And we appreciate the fact that there is specific language that says, no, those psychiatric records, those medical records are not part of the information. We think that's an important step. Like everyone else, we just received these Dash 3s and would like to be able to look at them further. But at this point, if that language is included, we can be comfortable with the bill.
Questions for these witnesses? Thank you both very much. There was no one else on the list. Is there anyone else here who would like to speak? Thank you. It looked like you might want to speak.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is Bob Junduff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon, and I want to thank all involved for involving us in discussions on this issue. I spoke with Mr. Yandell, and he indicates that he has forwarded to you some of the concerns that we had about the bill. I just wanted to articulate them quickly. And some of them are broad and some are very precise. So looking at the Dash 3 amendments on line 19, it refers to the statute ORS 161-365, and it says that a person who has been committed under that statute has their name forwarded to the FBI, in essence. And that is a statute that is about persons being committed to the state hospital for an evaluation to determine if they're competent enough to face their criminal charges. So it's not a finding of mental illness. It's not a finding of dangerousness. It's a person who's committed to the state hospital for an evaluation. Many people in that same circumstance are not sent to the state hospital. They have a local evaluation by a local a psychologist or psychiatrist. And so this, to us, seems particularly problematic because not only is the person not being committed because they've been found to be mentally ill or have been found to be dangerous or it's just for an evaluation. And so that was a concern that we had. We also had a concern on line 21. It refers to ORS 161-290. It's a person who's been found guilty except for insanity of a crime. Those are people who have raised a defense of immaturity. In other words, they're not old enough to have formed the mental state to commit the crime. And so we have some concerns that there may be people who are being pulled into a registry because they were too young to be convicted of a crime, and somehow they're involved in the gun registry, and we're not quite sure what the logic of that is. Our other concerns were that while the federal law that we've had an opportunity to review discusses that people should have opportunities to not to show that they shouldn't have their names on the list. And in fact, much to the, again, credit of folks who've worked on this, that this PSRB process has been put into effect. They also mentioned two other factors, and one is that people should have an opportunity to expunge their crimes, inappropriate circumstances, or civil commitment. And while there was a bill in this session that would have allowed for expungement of civil commitment, that bill did not move and is now dead. And so there is no provision in state law that allows for expungement of a civil commitment. And there's also note in the federal law that individuals should receive notice that when they're entering into any of these processes, that one of the effects can be they're not being able to own or purchase firearms, and we do not have any provisions there. Now, again, that's something we can work on in the future, but we don't have that included in this bill. The last point is a more broad philosophical one that you've heard earlier, which is that this federal law says that people who have mental health, who ended up being committed because of mental health problems, are automatically on the registry, but there's no requirement that people be found to be dangerous. In a normal civil commitment, a person has to be civilly committed if they have a mental disorder which causes them either to be dangerous to themselves or others, or unable to care for their basic needs. And so there's an entire category of people who can be committed without a finding of dangerousness. And by the same token, that can happen in the criminal sector. Admittedly, that's a smaller portion of the individuals affected. But so you have folks who they've never been adjudicated to be meant to be dangerous, never been found in any proceeding to be dangerous. There's never been any showing that they've done anything dangerous, and yet just because they have a mental illness or developmental disability or mental retardation under state law, they now have this prohibition, and we are of the opinion that that's discriminatory.
So. That might even answer your question.
I think it affirmed my concern.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, the hour is late and I'm a little tired. And we started this hearing with the comment that we are one of five states who is not a member of this registry. And somebody thinks we need to be, the governor. If we're only one of five, I would never send anybody to California to find out how they do it. But surely these other states have dealt with these issues. We aren't breaking new ground. This is clearly not ready for prime time, but it seems to me that we ought to be able to get there at some measure and not just start from scratch. So I would encourage these people to go back and keep working and maybe even look around and see how this is handled in those 45 other states who have managed to come to terms with this at some level, because the players are the same in every state, I can guarantee you. We aren't that unique. So please go back, get back to work, and let's get there if we can. I have no emergency to do it this session, but maybe somebody else does. But it just shouldn't be this hard if 45 other states have managed to get there. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little grouchy because I'm tired.
I'm pleased. I feel from the time the bill came to our committee to where it is now, there's been major improvements made. And I tend to agree with Representative Berger that there is probably a pathway to get there and get something. We're not there yet. And yes, come on up if you want for a second.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, David Yandell, State Police. I take full responsibility for the numbers that Mr. O'Leary provided you. That was our original understanding, that we were one of only about five states, but in the process of our deliberating over this, we've learned that there's roughly half the states, and I'll give you the exact numbers.
That doesn't make me feel better.
Right. There are still some that have done it, so...
That does make me feel better. And please don't model anything after California.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, we understand your point, and we have been working diligently this last year to seek a way to see Oregon compliant without any legislative efforts. But the relief provision, for instance, can't be done any other way but through legislative action. And the other modifications that are contained in the Dash 3 are absolutely focused on the minimal requirements to allow the state of Oregon to be considered compliant. And beyond that, we still anticipate continuing to work with our stakeholders for some time to work through some of the other issues that we still need to address. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess with that, I'm going to close the hearing on the public hearing on House Bill 2853. And we will reschedule this at the time if we can get a bill that actually can work. And I have a tendency to agree with you that I'm not in any hurry, but I do want it to be right. So we'll keep you informed, and I'll work with all the people to see where we're at with that. And with that, we will close the session for the Rules Committee. So thank you all for being here.